This is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live with a wonderful guest today. Always wonderful guests. Every guest has a really different slant on how to approach life and living and loving and expressing it. And as you know, love letters are for anyone at any time and for any reason. And spreading happiness is a really good reason to write a love letter. And although you don't have to be happy to write a love letter, you can find something positive to write as a rule, even in the most negative kind of circumstance. But happiness is an important issue. People are always looking for it. And my guest today is Rabbi Peretz Mutchkin, who I became aware of this because I saw that he was giving a course on happiness. And the actual phrase that got me is where happiness lives. So I'm going to turn it right over to you. And just tell a little bit about yourself and what this course is. And how do you start talking to people about happiness and where one finds it?
Firstly, so great to be here with you.
Thank you.
As always. Always such a positive aura about you.
Well, I feel that way about you. I love everything that comes out of your mouth.
Well, we're part of the Mutual Admiration Society then. Well, this course I thought was a tremendous opportunity, especially, you know, for our generation that may have a hard time always being happy, even though we have such a successful era that we're living in. Really, we're lucky to live in the United States and have so many wonderful things around us. And even the worldwide trouble today is different than it used to be.
Yes.
There is definitely an elevated level that we could be living at, a happy level we could be living at.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the world, it's different because it's scarier.
I see a lot of positivity even within the challenge,
right?
Which we'll see is kind of a bit of the secret here. And just think about historically what challenges really looked like versus what our challenges today look like. And we're already making headway. Just the fact that we can really scrutinize what used to be the norm. We're really upset about Russia going into Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few generations ago, conquest was part of living. One country would take over another.
Uh-huh.
And today we're disturbed by that because we feel like there should be a higher and elevated status of living. So that's already something beautiful. And when you start thinking about that, you're empowered to start doing things. That is, to me, what happiness is supposed to be. Joy is something that empowers you. So when you talk about love letters,
happiness is, when you say that's what happiness is supposed to be, you mean that kind of awareness?
I think it's an empowerment.
Uh-huh.
It's okay. The awareness is what allows you to be happy, but the result is in it. Yeah,
okay.
The result is to be empowered by it, by its energy. And I think love is that way too. You're empowered by love to basically go through challenges within a relationship, for instance. Love is obviously not only a necessary ingredient, but something that helps kind of propel you forward even during challenging times. Happiness is supposed to be that. And I think the main thing that we identified was that people are always looking to be happy after something has happened.
Oh.
When I finish this challenge, I'll be happy. When I accumulate this
fortune, yeah.
I will feel happy. And we're gonna really talk about how happiness is a very soulful idea and is gonna be going on while you're going through the challenge.
Okay.
So this course that we gave called How Happiness Thinks.
Oh, okay. Where happiness
No, no, no. That's a line in the course as well.
Oh, that's what I thought.
Oh, yes. You're not off. Okay. The contrary.
Okay.
Stu, that's the line that called to you.
Yes, it is.
And the course is called How Happiness Thinks because it takes perspective and thought to accumulate that perspective in order to really be happy. Where happiness lives is kind of like a question, a rhetorical question. Everybody knows happiness ultimately does not live in the material world. It lives
mm-hmm.
within yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that self is what we spoke about from a Jewish perspective as a soul self. And learning how to bring the soul to the forefront was really what made a real difference to people finding peace and joy.
I'm hoping you're going to say what a soul self is.
Ah, we can absolutely
talk about
it. That
sounds a little mysterious.
Well, in order to kind of understand soul, we have to talk about more spiritual character traits of a human being.
Okay.
For instance, humility. Humility is a kind of a lost art. Today, you hear the word being humble when you hear somebody say, I had an experience. I felt humble after the experience.
Yes, yes.
It was a humbling experience for me. But the truth is that humility is a sense of power and strength. In Jewish tradition, they have a very interesting line. it says that the most humble of all men was Moses. Now, first of all men, which indicates that women in general have a stronger sense of humility, and it's not supposed to be a less thing, it's a more thing, because we're talking about Moses, maybe the ultimate leader. And really, after you split the sea, I don't know if you could be called the most humble of all men. So what are they referring to?
Well, unless you realize you didn't do it.
Ah, there we go. But Moses had an interesting, even deeper character trait that was more than just, well, God did it for me, so that's why I'm humble. Moses believed that since his experience in life was a God-given experience, so if somebody else would have received the powers that he had, they probably would have done a better job. He had this constant idea about him that I got this incredible connection with God. I was able to have a conversation with God. I was able to learn about my strengths. If somebody else would have had that kind of open dialogue with God, like a real direct channel, imagine how successful they would be. They'd probably do a better job even than I would. That's like somebody saying, like, I worked really hard and I accumulated wealth and fortune, but if somebody else would have worked hard and accumulated their fortune, they may have had a better impact on the world. That's humility. It's knowing your strengths, knowing what your success is, and appreciating it.
And yet
feeling,
not making yourself the center of the universe.
Correct. You're really able to see somebody else as being able. So when you have that start, you can immediately start feeling happier immediately, knowing that what gratitude you can start having and what virtues you can start living up to when you really realize that, you know, it takes a lot more than just yourself for things to work in. You know, even people who have a hard time talking about God as a tangible idea, because it is difficult, and anybody who tells you it's not is misleading you. God is most definitely a difficult topic because we have a hard time explaining the infinite and the untangible when we're material people. You know, simply put, a sandwich sometimes calls out a lot more to me than God does in that sense.
Yeah.
So I very much think that by starting within, I would say, a relatable spiritual part of yourself, which is humility and learning how to have healthy humility, really changes your ability to have perspective about what it means to really have gratitude, which is obviously a close cousin of happiness and joy. So that's the premise.
No, but what about like, somehow I felt built into this concept was when you talked about people feel they want to find happiness, they want to be happy. There's a huge societal requirement to be happy or feel somehow like you failed. People are having fun, and they're happy and they're fine. And what is the... Where is the line where you can say real happiness instead of what we've chased down because the advertisers are telling us that will make us happy?
And commercialism does sometimes work against us. Mm-hmm. It seems to be painting a very happy picture, and yet we all know that at the end of that road is not happiness. At the same time, though, instead of rejecting the world around us, which I feel I often see, especially within religious figures or religious activities, you end up finding people who have a certain escapism from reality, and that's when they're hoping to find happiness. Even just an individual on the street will often say, I'll be on vacation, I'll be happy over there, I'm working towards that. And then they go on vacation, and when they get back, they need a vacation from the vacation. It doesn't always find the tranquil peace they were looking for.
So looking for happiness is kind of the wrong goal in this way?
Well, I think instead of looking for happiness, I think we have to actively find the tools that allow us to recognize that we are supposed to be happy people. For instance, we gave this course, How Happiness Thinks, it was six. One of the lessons, we focused on this idea of whether you see your job, as a career, or as a calling. And we made this distinction that if you see your job as a job, even if it's an incredible job, you end up just working for the money and working for the results of what you're putting your effort in, which is fine. You have to work. You have to accumulate what you need to accumulate. But at the same time, having a job is difficult. It's a laborsome activity. So there are others that elevate that and they say, well, you know, it's a career. I'm doing this in order to get to the next place, and this is a great stepping stone. What do they often say in politics? It's whichever job you get is a great stepping stone towards your next job.
Yes, that's right.
And that idea. And
I think people say that in a very denigrating way. Somebody is elected to a political office, and people say he's just using it as a stepping stone, and it diminishes him.
Agreed. In fact, I agree with that in general with the concept of having a career. That whole idea that I'm just doing this to get to the next is a really superficial way, and yet we're all guilty of it in some level, and often a lot of people get stuck the prime years of their life instead of focusing on where they truly impact their world. They're focusing on what am I using this to get towards the next part of my position. And that's a huge topic because people use this concept of job and career sometimes in familial relationships as well.
How?
They have siblings, and the reason why they're close to their siblings are either it's a labor, they're my siblings, so I have no choice but to have a relationship with them, or depending how you look at it, better or worse, they have a career connection with, listen, it's the right thing to do because when you have a good relationship with family, it gives you a better X, Y, and Z. It doesn't really matter. But immediately that it's beneficial changes what it's supposed to be, and that is you're connected, so you're supposed to work on all the facets of familial relationships independent of what it will bring towards you.
Okay, so two things. You're talking about living in the moment, it seems.
A bit of that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there is that be aware of what you have now, but also the business of the stepping stone. There's a difference between knowing that you're doing good in this world by whatever you do. I mean, we're all on the same ship. And if everybody does something, the ship stays afloat. And it doesn't have to be glamorous.
I just would comment that they found a scientific finding that they were doing this kind of study on whether the job makes a difference to this overall method of seeing your life versus a job, career, or a calling, like we'll get to in a moment. And they found that just as many people with low-level jobs, at least what society calls a low-level job, were just as happy, if not happier, because they saw their job as a calling. And a calling meant that they saw a significant purpose by living up to their potential within what they were doing now. This is my job right now. I'm going to be the best at this job.
And like, also,
this
is if that job is strictly to earn the money to take care of your children and your family,
it may not be enough ever. You may not feel fulfilled enough to give over that value.
But you could.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's a really important thing. So you have a job that's not the best job in the world, but look what you're providing. I think that's important.
Very much agree.
You could certainly find a lot of happiness in that if your view is one that's fortunate for you.
Agreed. I think the calling idea becomes a huge idea. Living your life as a calling.
Okay, living your life as a calling. Go ahead.
That was the changing point, was for sure to see your job as that. So you're not laborsome going to work. But more importantly, in your active life, you have to believe that your life is meaningful and purposeful. And hence the Jewish idea behind being happy is that you being alive means you have purpose.
Okay, so you've just stepped up that next level.
We bring it up to the next level.
Go ahead.
And I think this is where Judaism really has a lot to offer in the world of being happy. Judaism has this innate idea that purpose is not just in the big things. When something big happens, a great promotion or the great love of your life. Purpose is in the small things, whether you brushed your teeth, whether you cleaned yourself. And it sounds trivial that it should be my prerogative, but a Jewish perspective is you living up to your potential every moment of the day is important. There's this idea that before we eat something, we say a blessing. And I'll ask people of all levels of Jewish tradition, why would you say a blessing before you eat? And they say, what do you mean to say thank you? And I say, well, if you can, you know, indulge in this conversation, try to say any of the words of blessing before you eat and see if there's a thank you involved in those words.
Okay.
And it turns out there isn't. We don't say thank you before we eat. We actually say thank you after we eat.
Makes sense. That's the tradition of
Abraham, our forefathers. He was the first to institute an idea of being thankful and having gratitude after. Meaning, just to bring it back for a moment, being happy needs to be in the moment, as we're saying. And being grateful has to be after the fact. And that has to go back and forth. Not being happy and grateful only after I achieve what has happened. So what are we saying before we eat?
That's what I want to know.
That's the big question. So really, it's a one-line meditation, completely bringing your mind to be present in what's happening. So when you drink something there's no such thing as putting something in your body that you're not mindful of before you do it. Yes. You eat something, there's no such thing as eating something and not being mindful of it before you eat it. Hence, you could see that even doesn't matter the level of religion, if you're not tuning into what a blessing is, you're missing the grand design of blessing. Blessing doesn't mean thank you. Blessing means to draw close, to draw near. So when people say, oh, that person's happy, such a blessing, they're happy.
The word in Hebrew actually Baruch, means to draw near?
Right, Baruch, which is translated as blessing,
yes.
Kabbalistically means to draw close, kind of to bend down, to draw near. Just the way we bend down as a sign of propelling forward, like it's the whole you back up to jump forward, etc. Blessing brings to mind that idea of the backwards movement to make one step back for two steps forward is the meditative idea behind the blessing before we eat or do something. So we're always mindful and present. And that is what ultimately is going to give you perpetual joy and happiness because you will be in the moment. And anytime somebody will talk to me about struggling with any form of life, the first thing I'll think about is, where can I add a blessing to that area? And where people translate that as, Rabbi, give me a blessing, I never answer them what they're looking for. They're looking for the quick fix. Just give me a blessing that it's going
to
work out.
And what's that supposed to do, give me a blessing?
I don't know. I don't have magical powers, you know? I work on myself just like anyone else, you know? I'm not holier than somebody else. The rabbi is just the title. Life and living really the real title. So in that regard, finding a blessing for me means finding the person an opportunity to be mindful about the experience they're going to have. And by being able to have that, that's where the sense of humility comes in. And of course, now humility is translated as a sense of power, not a sense of less of self, but more of self. And when you could actually
nice distinction.
I think that changes the conversation. Imagine if you could tell somebody you should be more humble, and instead of them being all defensive, like, what, I'm full of myself, no, you're actually saying that you should be more humble as you should realize you are so talented. Everyone here has something really unique to offer, and we need to really start thinking about how we're capable of putting ourselves on display and putting ourselves out there in the best way possible.
So it would be very nice and very helpful, I'm thinking, if the evolution of language didn't kind of louse this up on the way.
It happens.
You know, you see people saying to other people when they're being a little full of themselves, you know, let's have a little humility here. What should they be saying?
Well, I think it would take, you need to take the time to think for yourself of how you want to express that to somebody else. And more than coming up with the word, because in the English language and our cultural way of constantly finding new hip words and ways of expressing ourselves, it'll get lost again. So it's not just about finding the new words. It's about finding a deeper way to express that. Hebrew has that beautiful ability to be a timeless language. At least biblical Hebrew is timeless in the sense of the word Baruch, even though it's become translated as blessing. You can always give people a new trigger that when they say blessing, they now think of something more.
Yes.
So I kind of focus on finding the opportunities to give people a deeper insight to the words they're already using so that it creates new triggers for them.
Yes.
And when they think of humility, they think of empowerment. When they think of blessing, they think of being in the moment and being mindful. And I really do think that these are more soul-like ideas. People often, they think of God and soul, they start running away with it. Like, it's hard to really grasp what those ideas are, but maybe they're not so challenging if you start thinking of yourself first in a qualitative sense. My soul is an identity that does not want to gain from this world, but wants to give. And it has zero conflict over that. My soul is not in conflict. My soul is only in conflict because I won't live up to its potential. But in and of itself, a soul has no connection to the material world. All it wants to do is be nicer to people, be better, contribute, make its mark. So all of a sudden, instead of thinking about soul as this like flying ghost-like concept in the air, you stop thinking about it in terms of material because it's not. It's a spiritual entity. It's the life behind living is what is my impact like? Once you start thinking like that, you stop thinking of in grand terms like, did I change the world versus did I change myself? Have I really, you know, looked at my character and said, I can be a better character individual?
Of course, if everybody did that, we'd be in good shape.
We'd be in good shape. Yeah. But, you know, the good thing is that we can all do that. And I think we are today. I think that's what really makes me happier when I say, like, you know, we're seeing in the world the way, let's say, Russia went into Ukraine and how we think about it differently today. I think that's a soulful thing. I think, like, if we were all body people, mm-hmm. we'd be like, what do you mean? Conquest, war. We'd mm-hmm. be comfortable with bloodshed because this is the way of the world. And by comfortable, I don't mean happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it's what it is.
Yes.
As the old Yiddish idea, a pogrom is a pogrom. Challenges happen. Big deal. I think we're uncomfortable with the world being in a state of challenge because we're more soulful today. I don't know if we're necessarily smarter, but yes. I think we are soulful. And I think it's the soul that leads us to success more than our brains.
Well, and people sense. And people are looking for that side of themselves, which is why they're coming to you for
Well, I to get learn. To live in San Francisco, so oftentimes I have to go to the people.
But receive you well.
But we're doing as far as I can tell, we're doing every day more than yesterday. So that's good enough for me. I'm happy to be here.
So what are some of the other concepts in this? Just because maybe you'll come back and talk about another one sometime. I flipped through that book and I just saw the word how to trust.
How to trust. Well, that would be a whole new topic.
Okay, well, so another time.
Well, we can do a little bit now. Okay. I think the idea of trust is, once again, is knowing in what areas to put yourself out there. There's an old Hasidic tale of the gentleman who comes to his rabbi and says, you know, I go to synagogue, but I can't go anymore because for whatever reason, every time I go, somebody's stepping on me. And I just don't like it. It's packed and people are stepping on my feet. Literally, I'm uncomfortable. And the rabbi says, it looks at him and says, you know, I think you're putting your feet under everybody else's feet. And of course, what he was saying was that, you know, you're putting yourself in such a position where you're not giving any space to anyone around.
Oh.
And interestingly enough, the first space to be in to start having trust with others isn't anything other than giving other people space, and you can start learning about people. You're not going to trust somebody who you gave space to and then consumed you.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, that's not the person you're supposed to be building trust with. That's the person to have the professional relationship with. How do you know which person to build trust with is more important than just knowing where trust is? If you put it in the wrong place and it gets violated, mm-hmm. then you end up not doing it again. And you
Hopefully,
lose out
yes.
on
yeah.
tremendous opportunities. So that's why trust to me is a larger dialogue, is connected to happiness loosely. And in an idea that ultimately happiness is going to come down to being present. And
oh, that's what I was saying, yeah.
And as you're being present, as you learn to be present, it'll evolve. Your being present will you'll accumulate a lot more, kind of like developing your peripheral vision,
mm-hmm.
being able to constantly add towards what being present is. You're noticing more things about you, and you become a student of your own life.
Now, what about letting go of some of the horrors in the world and not letting that burden you with the ugliness?
I find that today where people sometimes, I mean, there's two ways to see that.
I mean, I wake up every morning, I'm a cheerful human being. I wake up with is this a brand new day attitude? And I read the newspaper, and within 2 minutes, I am screaming at my husband.
Well, I'm going to tell you what I was getting towards. And
Please.
that is, you got to perpetuate that morning feeling for a few more minutes. You got to re-examine your morning ritual and maybe perpetuate the happy moments an extra couple of minutes, maybe even just one more minute a day. Meaning, if you're not going to be empowered by the morning newspaper experience and instead it's going to actually have a counterintuitive effect, which very common, obviously, people see something negative in the news and they just have this like inside sense saying like, nothing I'm going to do matters anyways. Like it's all hell, you know, it's all challenge. So the mornings are probably the most important time to perpetuate the clear feeling of morning. And this is kind of what the course did as far as like, a lot of these things aren't mutually exclusive to Judaism. A lot of these things I'm saying could be just in conversation. People, if they spoke about this enough, could come up with a lot of these things themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't speak enough about it. We don't
yes.
contemplate
yes.
enough about it. The Jewish addition here was the affirmations that Judaism wants you to do. By affirmations, I mean actually telling yourself certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So in the world, you see oftentimes people say, you know, you deserve this, or you're good enough. But that's kind of misleading, because by saying you're good enough or you deserve these things, what you're saying is that independent of others, I am what's important. Mm-hmm. But you're not cultivating that I. You're not discovering that I.
Okay, so you really are saying that. So then my question kind of was, are we allowed to step back from the ugliness and say, not on our to-do list, I've got to take care of who I am.
But how do you do that without compromising the possibility of actually contributing to the mess? Mm-hmm. Right? That's the big question, really. And the first thing a Jew says in the morning, and a Jew, anybody could say this really, but this is the Jewish line, is called the Moda Ani. So Moda Ani in Hebrew is Moda Ani Lefanecha Melech Chai V'Kayam Shehachazarta B'Nishmasi B'Chemla Rabba Emunasecha. This line means basically we're saying to God that I trust in you, I have faith in you, you returned my soul to me. But there's like once again a much deeper message here.
What is it?
And the first introduction to the deeper message here is that God's name does not appear in this line. Mm-hmm. Moda Ani is that Moda means I'm grateful, but it's also looking yourself in the mirror. I acknowledge. I see the big picture. And Ani is I. You know when you know somebody really well, you stop using their name at a certain point? Mm-hmm. Like in a loving relationship, all sorts of dears and honeys are used.
Oh, you don't? Yes, it's creepy to use a person's name too much.
You don't use the name so much?
Right.
Even more, at a certain point, you could say, hey, what's going on? You're not even alluding anymore to their identity. You're going beyond.
Yes.
Yet in the street, if somebody said, hey, you, you'd be offended. What do you mean you? I have a name. I'm a someone, you know? What do you mean you? So interestingly enough, we also have a hard time acknowledging ourselves to the plainest form of who are we after all. We're and the best moment of really acknowledging your full identity is right when you wake up.
Okay.
There's always a clear moment right there.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing we say is my Ani, my real I is at the forefront here. And the only real like space you can really have that full you, take a really, let's call it a naked look at yourself, is Lefanecha, before God. Before God doesn't mean an old man in the sky. Mm-hmm. It means wherever you're holding in what God is to you at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning your highest capacity of spirituality and godliness and mysticism, wherever you're holding in life, that's what you're confronting when you wake up in the morning. And when you're able to do that, you immediately perpetuate this, the best side of yourself for an extra couple of moments. And those couple of moments make all the difference in allowing you to have the perspective it takes to get through your day. Because then you become somebody who's always looking to be a contributor and a doer and adding. Even if you end up not having a busy schedule ahead of you, you end up smiling more to people because you're reminded that I should showcase the best parts of myself.
And you gotta hit that refresh button every morning.
Every morning.
Okay.
Well, we get to anyways.
Yes.
You know? How challenging it would be without sleep to ever find self. You know, we'd just be constantly dealing
with
things.
We crumble, don't we? Yes.
Well, and you know, and Judaism's big difference between that and, let's say, other religions, just because as a rabbi I'm teaching from a Jewish perspective, is life cycles in the world are considered a circular thing. History repeats itself. Mm-hmm. Things continuously. In Buddhism, it's a circle of life.
Mm-hmm.
Judaism is all about the spiral, not the circle. Things do come again, but on a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we don't always get to appreciate that higher level because we're still stuck on the level beforehand. And this idea is ultimately what helps us now. Up until now, we're talking about all these cute things to be happy. Mm-hmm. By cute, I mean they don't deal with the obvious. What about the real challenges? Meaning it's like you can gain perspective in not allowing the news to affect you. But what happens when it's personal?
Mm-hmm.
And that is where the spiral message comes into effect. The first Hasidic master, famous Hasidic master, the Baal Shem Tov, used to say, life is a spiral means right before you get to the next level, your back is turned towards the goal, because that's the nature of a spiral. You're not in a circle constantly seeing. In a spiral, you have to be backwards, the last step, before you turn forward again. So if one can see the challenge as the indicator to what's happening in their life, they can attack that challenge with absolute joy, happiness, and a sense of, this was designed for me. So these are huge ideas to help one literally blow away their previous perspective and allow them to constantly find more levels of joy.
And you can't do that standing on one foot. I mean, this takes obviously practice and steeping yourself in it.
You actually don't need any feet. In morning, you're in bed. It's fantastic.
Perfect.
So first thing, we don't, you know, put a little paper next to your bed with the Modani meditation and confront yourself before you get on your feet.
I just want to thank you for doing this. This is just wonderful in every possible way, and you make it all so understandable. So we didn't get to talk about love letters, which I usually like to do, but I think it's clear that as I say all the time, because I do believe it, that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, as you can hear from Rabbi Munchkin, every moment has the seeds of a love letter to somebody. Maybe yourself, maybe, it doesn't even matter. But you can always express that happiness you find and share it with somebody, would you say?
I would say.
Put it on a piece of paper, stamp it, and mail
it. People are sometimes afraid to write to themselves because they feel like there's something hoity about it, you know, like I'm propping myself up. But I think using the concept of humility, you could learn how to approach yourself from such a new and uplifting way. And hopefully that'll lead to acknowledging all the goodness around
you. That's wonderful. I mean, writing it down and, yes, doing it in that way is a whole new... We'll have to talk about this some more another time, because that's a whole new way to approach yourself and how you talk to yourself, which you've certainly touched on. Well, thank you, dear. Until next time, this is Janet Gallen and
Rabbi Peretz Munchkin
saying goodbye.